You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. It's Monday, September 27th, 2010. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Anne Hood, whose latest novel is The Red Thread, published by W.W. Norton & Company. Anne Hood was born in West Warwick, Rhode Island. She grew up with stories of her father's travels around the world during his 20 years in the Navy. These stories inspired her to become a flight attendant for TWA after receiving her B.A. in English from the University of Rhode Island. She lived in Boston and St. Louis before moving to New York City, where she attended graduate school in American Literature at NYU. During a furlough from TWA, she worked on her first novel, Somewhere Off the Coast of Maine. Back to work on international flights, she often wrote on the long subway ride to JFK and in the galleys of 747s while the passengers slept. In 1987, Somewhere Off the Coast of Maine was published by Bantam as one of the launch books for their original paperback series, Bantam New Fiction. After leaving the airline and becoming a full-time writer, she published essays and short stories in the Washington Post, Mademoiselle, Red Book, Story, and other magazines. At various times over the years, she has had regular columns in Self, Glamour, New Woman, and Parenting. Most recently, she's the author of the best-selling novel, The Knitting Circle, and the memoir, Comfort, A Journey Through Grief, which was named one of the top 10 nonfiction books of 2008 by Entertainment Weekly and was a New York Times editor's choice. Her other novels include Waiting to Vanish, Three-Legged Horse, Something Blue, Places to Stay the Night, The Properties of Water, and Ruby. She's also written a memoir, Do Not Go Gentle, My Search for Miracles in a Cynical Time, and a book on the craft of writing, Creating Character Emotions. And she has a collection of short stories, An Ornithologist's Guide to Life. Her essays and short stories have appeared in Good Housekeeping, The New York Times, Ladies' Home Journal, More, Tin House, Plowshares, and The Paris Review. Anne Hood has won a Best American Spiritual Writing Award, the Paul Bowles Prize for Short Fiction, and two Pushcart Prizes. She now lives in Providence, Rhode Island, with her husband and their children. I spoke to Anne Hood after she read at the Burlington Book Festival this weekend, which was a fabulous event. We began by talking about how she came to write The Red Thread.
In 2005, we adopted our daughter Annabelle from China, and I think I had heard of the idea of the red thread long ago, because it's not that rare. I mean, people know about it. They know what it means when they hear it. And I think I'd heard about it and always felt it was a very interesting idea that the people who we love are connected to us by an invisible red thread, and that no matter how tangled or frayed that thread becomes, they're still waiting at the other end. Mm-hmm. And this is an idea that the adoption community really embraced. And I think it comes from the disappointment and kind of dashed hopes that often lead to someone going to adopt. And also because adoption takes a lot of time and a lot of stamina and a lot of waiting. And I think the idea of the red thread, where there's a baby at the other end of it, through all that can be quite uplifting and keep you hanging in there, you know?
Right.
And so, like everything, as I was going through the adoption process, I wasn't imagining it as a book. I mean, sometimes that's what people think, that writers, as we live our lives, are taking notes for our book about it. But really, you have so many experiences that you never write about. And the adoption process was long and emotionally very charged. Going to China to pick up our daughter was an incredible 2 weeks. So I wasn't really thinking about writing.
Mm-hmm.
But once I had her at home, and I was settling back into a writing routine, one of the things I was thinking about a lot as I looked at this beautiful baby was her mother, you know, the woman who had given birth to her, who didn't realize she had traveled 10,000 miles mm-hmm. and was living in a little house on the east side of Providence, Rhode Island, you know, about as far away from Hunan Province as you could be. And I began to imagine who that woman was. And then my fictional self took over, and I started to create characters maybe she's this person, maybe she's a person like this, you know. But I didn't feel like I could write, or wanted to write a whole book about that took place in China and with the women who are suffering there because of the one-child policy. So the natural instinct was, well, I'll follow families adopting from China, and so I'll have the American stories and their counterparts. And I worked very hard on matching them up in the book.
Yeah, yeah, that was great.
The red thread that you just mentioned, is that a Chinese idea?
It is
a Chinese idea.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
When I went to write it, because I wanted it at the beginning of the book as sort of almost like a guide into the story so that people are thinking, well, whose red thread is going to connect to whose red thread?
Yeah, right.
You know, I found many 1, 2, 3 sentence descriptions of it in books, online, everywhere. And so it basically says the same thing. So it's more of an idea.
Right. And there's no attribution. It's
no
lore.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how your own life influenced the material in this book. And I know you mentioned your daughter Annabelle and going through the adoption process, but I know you lost a daughter before that.
Yeah. In 2002, we lost our daughter Grace, who was 5 years old, and she died from a virulent form of strep. I always used my own life experience prior to Grace's death in my books because I think you want to find the emotional truth and then change the props. That's how I look at it. So often people don't recognize my own experience in something I've written because I've so changed the props, mm-hmm. but the universal or emotional impact is still there. After Grace died, I didn't write for several years. And what I did do was I learned to knit. It was like a full-time job. I knit all the time. And it's no surprise then that the next novel that I wrote after Grace died was about a woman who learned to knit to get through her grief. But even that, I really did not want to write my own story because I wasn't ready to, number one. And secondly, life and fiction are very different. And a lot of the things that I had done, like learning to knit, weren't really that interesting or exciting. I learned in a pretty basic way, and, you know, I just did the basic knitting class, and so I had to create a fictional world that was a little more ratcheted up,
right.
A little more dramatic.
Yeah.
And so I changed all the props, and that person, the protagonist of the knitting circle, isn't me at all, and her experience isn't mine, except for that she does lose a child and learns to knit.
Mm-hmm.
And so, similarly with the red thread, I'm none of the people in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But the woman who runs the adoption agency runs that agency, started that agency because she lost a child, and she feels guilty about that.
Mm-hmm.
And what I learned in all my grief work over these 8 years since Grace died is that many people who lose children turn to a new occupation that helps other people to avoid the pain they're going through.
Mm.
A wonderful example to illustrate it is Candace Leitner, who started Mothers Against Drunk Driving after her daughter was killed by a drunk driver. And it's almost like a self-imposed therapy. I mean, I don't think she would have said it was therapy, but it actually helps you move through grief to be able to, you know, prevent other people from having the same experience. And I took that idea, which I know to be true, and gave my character the Red Thread Adoption Agency because she, after losing her daughter and feeling responsible for that loss, is giving daughters to everyone.
So. Right. I wonder, you know, you mentioned a minute ago about how you don't write about your own personal experience. You sometimes find that fiction comes to you around those experiences.
Yeah.
Do you find it hard in situations like this, right here where we're sitting, that I'm asking you about that personal experience because it's the root of your fiction? Does that get to be tiresome?
No, it doesn't because I'm a writer who does write nonfiction, and so they kind of blur together, I think, for a lot of readers, which is fine with me.
Yeah.
So, for example, The Knitting Circle is not my experience. I never joined this magical, fabulous knitting circle. I wanted one, so I created it fictionally, you know.
Right.
But I did write the memoir, Comfort, A Journey Through Grief. And it talks about knitting, and it talks about losing Grace. And so I think it's a natural confusion or blurring that people have, you know. And so that's fine. Once I chose to write about this, I expected to talk about it.
Okay.
And before I went on my book tour for the knitting circle, I kind of had a meltdown. I thought, what have I done? I'm going to get asked questions that at that time I didn't know I could answer without losing it, you know, without crying.
Well, that's what I wondered.
Often after an event, I'm wiped out because I tell my story, I hear stories. And that's the part that really makes me more vulnerable. I often get incredibly sad because I think life is hard.
Yeah.
You know, I've heard some incredibly sad stories in the last however many years it's been since the knitting, I guess 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
But people feel they can share it. And often someone who's with that person comes up to me and says, this is the first time she's talked about it. So I feel like it's a gift to me.
Right.
You know, I often say that writing is a talent or gift. And if I'm using that in that way, then I have to, I think, receive what it
brings
opens
you.
Up. Yes.
Right,
yeah.
Right. You mentioned about the knitting, and knitting is a source of comfort to some of the characters in this book as well.
Yeah.
Is knitting a talisman for you in your writing work?
Oh.
Like, do you like to include it now in all your work?
That is a great question that no one has ever asked me. You know, I remember consciously deciding to not put knitting in The Red Thread because I thought it might be like a cheap trick, kind of like, oh, if you liked the knitting circle, wait till you see them making sweaters in The Red Thread. But then I realized that I was covering, I think I have like 14 characters, and that it was okay if some of them knit.
Yeah.
And I like...
Statistically, it was probable.
It was probable. And also, I liked... It helped define certain characters. And so one of the first stories that I wrote that appears in The Red Thread is the woman who has a daughter with Fragile X syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved the idea that her grandmother had taught her to knit. And fictionally, it worked because her knitting is a way of connecting to her grandmother because she can't connect with her mother or daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So I just... The thread, no,
right, well, it
pun intended.
Sort of, no, but it does. It
yeah,
extends
the idea
that
of threads,
sure.
Exactly. So
yeah.
It fit. It did ultimately fit.
Yeah. So The Red Thread is about several families that come to a certain adoption agency, which we've already mentioned is called The Red Thread, in order to adopt Chinese baby girls. And one aspect of this book that I loved, which you also mentioned, was that you not only just tell the story of American families, but you tell the stories of the Chinese families whose babies are given up. And this is based on some real situations that exist in China because of the one-child policy.
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, a lot of people I've learned since the book came out understand the one-child policy to be that you're only allowed to have one child and it has to be a boy. But that isn't the policy. You're allowed to have one child. It can be a girl or boy. But culturally in China, boys are preferred. And the policy was created in the 70s because the population was so out of control in China. And they tried to figure out a way to convince people to have fewer children. And they used the idea of wanting a boy as a way to actually have the one-child policy work. And it has worked. You know, I was in China in January, and I was talking to our guide about it in Beijing, and she was very proud of what it's done to the population of China. She, you know, quoted me statistics on it would have been this, and instead it's this, which is much more manageable for the country. So they're proud of the policy. Unfortunately, it's putting women in a very precarious position because boys are preferred. If you can only have one child and it's a girl, the girls are getting abandoned, which is illegal. So it's illegal to have girls. It's illegal to abandon girls. And women are forced to often at night walk very, very far, abandon their baby daughters, you know, at orphanage doors or police stations or someplace where there's foot traffic, and go back and try to have a boy.
Mm-hmm.
The policy is translated differently in different parts of the country. So although it's a national policy, there are provincial interpretations. And in big cities like Beijing and Shanghai, which actually is what most people think of when they think of China now, because of the Olympics, I think, and because Shanghai's architecture is almost looks like the Jetsons. There's always pictures of it.
Right,
you know.
Right.
There, it's very loosely interpreted. And also there, people are wealthier, and they'll pay the fine to have more children. So you'll see families of 3 or 4, girls and boys, in those cities. But it's like 70 to 80% of China's rural. And that's where the problem really is.
Mm-hmm.
So in Hunan, for example, which is the province my daughter's from, you can have a second child only if your first one was a girl, and the second child must be a boy. And therefore, most of the abandoned girls, they are second and third and even fourth daughters. So there's a girl at home, and they need a boy, and they have another girl, and another girl. And
so what's the official policy about having a second daughter?
If you are caught, what's the official policy? You can't. That's the official policy. And if you try to keep that child, which one of my characters does in The Red Thread, and you're caught, there's a very stiff fine. Now, I have to say, for us sitting in this beautiful Burlington, Vermont, it probably wouldn't ruin us. But in rural China, mm-hmm. it's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, in Beijing, people often pay the fine. You know, they have more money.
Right.
But the other thing is that you lose social services, and that's what really can destroy families, because in China, you live with your elderly relatives.
Mm-hmm.
And if you lose health care for your children and your grandparents, it's really shameful and can be dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so often husbands or male relatives will take the child when she reaches 5 months or 6 months, when she's not as dependent on the mother. I mean, a five-month-old is, but they're not held
right
every minute like a newborn. And they will take the child and leave her somewhere.
Abandon her.
Yeah.
Well, many of the characters in this book, on both sides of the story, are undergoing great stress in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And for some of them, and even the Americans, this means that they behave somewhat badly at
mm-hmm.
times. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've had some adoption groups who came to a reading, and someone will say, our group did none of those things. Neither did my group. But no one wants to read a kind of an ordinary experience. In fiction, we're asked, the contract is kind of between reader and writer, I am going to dramatize these emotions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have people act badly. I'm going to have consequences. It's not going to be everybody's nice and they wait and they get their babies. That's like a short magazine article, you know? Once you open a novel, you expect some drama,
right?
You know?
And I didn't think any of these stories was unbelievable.
No.
I mean, certainly not.
And you expect moral dilemmas. I mean, that's what fiction revolves around, right? Making
right.
choices. And
yeah.
so in the families, there's a very big flirtation between two of the characters. But I believe I created characters who it's believable that that would have happened.
Mm-hmm.
In any other situation, without the heightened emotions of being in that adoption world and waiting and trying to figure out if you're doing the right thing and questioning everything about your life, including your spouse and choices you've made, that's why they come together. But had they met anywhere else, they probably wouldn't have even liked each other. They're
right.
very different people.
Yeah.
That's actually one of my favorite dramatic storylines in the book. Yes, storylines.
Yeah. Yeah. I found it very interesting to read about the people going through the stress of waiting for their adopted babies.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminded me of friends I know who've gone through IVF and have had the stress of, am I getting pregnant? Am I getting pregnant?
That's right.
And I never thought about it from the point of view of, is our adoption going to come through? But it seemed like a similar kind of stress.
Is it ever going to happen?
Right.
You know? And actually, I placed the book, because I wrote it a few years ago, it takes a few years to finish and then to come out. At the time I wrote it, the wait was about a year to year and a half. It's now 5 years for China.
Wow.
And
wow.
so people I was talking to while I was writing it, and since it's come out and I've talked to a lot of adoption groups, talk about stress. 3 years passes, 4 years pass. I mean, it's really been a big shift in their international adoption world in China.
Sure. And well, the laws have changed so much in other countries. Now Russia's not letting their children be adopted
right.
by Americans. I don't know if that's true of Europe
right.
as well, but so yes. that must put more pressure on certain other countries.
Yeah, Vietnam is closed. Guatemala is closed. These are the places people, you know, had come to, I hate to say rely on, but know were reliable and they
right.
were traveling to. And so it's really, the landscape's changed a lot. Interestingly, many people now are going back to domestic adoptions. You know, the adoption world is a moving target.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's always different.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe this would be a good time for you to read
sure.
a couple minutes
yeah.
Or a few pages from
yeah.
the Red Thread.
I like to read the sections that illuminate the plight of the Chinese women
mm-hmm.
because I feel like, and I love my families, those characters who are going through the adoption, and many people have said they're recognizable as people they know. I mean, not literally, but It's the women in China who I think are really people are connecting with because their stories are unknown. So that's what I like to read. And I've placed all of those women, except for one, in Hunan because I had traveled there. I've been there twice. That's where our daughter came from. And so this character, Wang Chan, is actually, this is the second time she's had to abandon a baby girl. Her husband wants a son. So... Who will get this baby? Wang Chun asks out loud. Who will take her in and cherish her? She lifts her baby daughter to her breast and guides it to the child's mouth. This baby is slow to suck, as if she knows her fate. Chun wills herself to keep such thoughts from her mind. It is all Yuan, destiny. To think of her daughter's fate will not change it. Hadn't her mother told her, the sky does not make dead-end streets for people? Hadn't her husband said when the first pain began just 5 days ago, remember, Chun, we can have many more babies if we must? Hadn't he told her this morning as she set out from their home with her baby in the sling, bouncing gently against her hip, remember, Chun, a girl is like water you pour out? And hadn't she nodded when he said this, as if she agreed with him, as if she too believed a daughter was just water that you poured out and let flow away? The child's sucking is lackluster and weak, and for an instant Chun's heart lifts. Perhaps this baby is sickly. Perhaps her weak sucking is a sign that she will not live long. Chun almost relishes the idea. If she is going to lose her daughter anyway, wouldn't it be easier now at only 5 days than later at 5 months or even 5 years? But then, as if the baby reads Chun's thoughts, she latches on hard and begins to suck voraciously. The baby lifts her eyes toward Chun, eyes that until this moment have not focused on anything at all. Instead, they have been cloudy and half shut like a kitten's. Now the baby settles her solemn gaze right on Chun's face and sucks the milk from her as if to say, "No, mother, I am here to stay."
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
For reading that. That was Anne Hood reading from The Red Thread, published by W.W. Norton and Company. The policy where the Chinese people, or not policy, but the preference for boys,
yeah.
Is that more a rural thing as well? And is that to do with superstitions that are maybe culturally more rural?
Yeah, well, you know, I think... No, I don't think it's a rural thing. I mean, it's culturally very ingrained. And even in Beijing, you see they're trying now to change people's minds about that because they now have a country with too many boys and there's not enough people to marry them because enough generations have passed since the 70s that they're finding a real shortage on wives. And so now they're trying to change people's mind. And you will see billboards in Beijing and Shanghai saying girls are valuable. Love your daughter. You know, just sort of a way to kind of slowly put into the psyche, you've got to love a girl too. After all these thousands of years of boys being preferred, and after 40 years of the one-child policy,
right.
They now are in a real predicament.
Sure, yeah. Is it likely that this book will be read in China?
We were told it will never be reprinted. You know, I'll never sell Chinese rights. Maybe Taiwan, but not China.
Mm.
Yeah.
Have you had any Chinese immigrants to America or Chinese Americans come up to you and talk to you about their experience of reading this book?
You know, I've had some wonderful experiences. And one of the ones that was really touching was the woman who runs the adoption agency we used in Boston, Lillian, who is from China. And she was very helpful at certain points in writing the book, or just checking facts for me, or me running a storyline by her for a mother in China. Is this feasible? And she was very direct, you know. But I did an event with her about a month ago, and she took me aside and she said, "What you've done is amazing. That you got into the Chinese psyche in the way that you did, and told the Chinese stories." And she was quite moved by it. It meant a lot because she sees both sides. She is Chinese. She works with China all the time in the adoptions. But she also is very familiar, obviously, with the American couples.
Yes. Right.
So that was, to me, really, it felt great.
Yeah. I loved the reading about the cultural differences that were so pronounced, and I loved this one part in particular where a woman has a baby, and her mother and her husband's mother come to visit, and the grandmothers call the baby ugly and stupid in an attempt to keep their dead ancestors from wanting to take the baby.
Yeah.
And I just loved that part because the grandmothers are smiling and they are so clearly just over the moon about this baby, but they're saying, "Oh, it's ugly. Oh, it's stupid."
Exactly. You know, in Asian culture, many Asian cultures, it's superstitious to compliment a baby.
Right.
And actually, I love the what they do. The Hmong culture, which is mostly in Cambodia and Vietnam, little babies, wear hats that only from above look like flowers, so that people, ancestors, mistake them for flowers and won't take them.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So there's so many of those that are just kind of lovely in a way.
Yeah. How did you research the Chinese traditions, the superstitions, the cultural details that you used in the book?
Yeah, you know, I love books that require research like that, you know, because I learn as much as someone who will read the book. It was complete serendipity that we had an exchange student from China living with us when I first began writing it. And she was not a warm and fuzzy young woman. She was not the exchange student of our dreams. But she sat with me and explained to me how Chinese people are named. And so all of the names, she gave me lists, and I would say, someone who was from this area, who had this personality, someone who was born at this time. And so I chose from lists that she helped me to make.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah. And she gave me all of the Chinese quotes, folklore that opens each section.
The epigraphs.
She gave me probably 50, and I chose one that suited what was going to happen, that reflected the action coming.
Mm-hmm.
And she talked to me about how people live in China, what they eat. A lot of the food was, you know, thanks to her. And the one-child policy, which she actually was very defensive about.
Mm-hmm.
She believed it was good. She said women in China do not abandon their babies. I said, how did we get Annabelle then, our daughter? Why was Annabelle found in a box on an orphanage door? Someone abandoned her. No, that was a very unusual circumstance. She was very... So I didn't get a lot of information about that from her because she was kind of in denial. A young girl, I mean, 17 years
old. That's what I was going to say. Is that denial or is that a little bit of a defense mechanism that I'm not supposed to speak ill of my country?
Yeah, I think it was a little both, actually. Mm. Yeah, definitely. So I didn't get information about that, but all of the little details that really helped to set and they authenticate the China experience came from her and me, you know, really questioning her until her eyes were rolling. And then I just did a lot of reading. You know, one of the wonderful things about our adoption agency is while we were waiting, I think it was to get families to stop calling and saying, are we next? Are we next? We have a baby. So kind of in the middle of the wait, they had us attend a Chinese culture weekend. And it was history and it was language and there was a reading list. And it just helped. I mean, at the time, I wasn't thinking about writing a book, but all of that helped. I kept, you know, I had kept it to show Annabelle someday. And so I used all of that information and read all the books on the list. And I did a lot of research that was fun.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you'll get another exchange student when Annabelle's a little bit older? Or was that experience a one-time deal?
You know, actually, we're very lucky. Brown University is part of a national organization on college campuses called ChinaCare.
Oh.
And Chinese students volunteer one Saturday a month to work with adopted Chinese kids.
Oh, how wonderful.
It's amazing. And so once a month, Annabelle goes to Brown, even though she's only six. She's been doing it since she was three. She goes to Brown. She has a Chinese lesson and then a Chinese cultural activity. So she's actually missing the Moon Festival is today, so she's here with me. But last year she went to the Moon Festival. They do a New Year's party. We go out for dim sum. And she's assigned a mentor. a Chinese student at Brown who is just for Annabelle. Mm-hmm. So we can utilize that relationship however we want. We can have her over for dinner. We can have her take Annabelle for Chinese food. We can have them play together. However we want to utilize that student, we can.
Oh, that's
so it's a wonder. So we don't need the exchange student.
What a great...
Yeah.
That's
and they're all over the country. It's a great organization, actually started by a young man when he went to Brown. And he traveled to China and he worked at an orphanage. And he was so moved that he returned with, when he graduated, and he was in medical school at that point, and he returned with other young people in their 20s. Sadly, that guy was killed in an accident. Mm. But the friends he brought with him kind of picked up his baton and started this program in his name.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I'm curious if you ever thought about developing any of these chapters into standalone stories and publishing them outside of the novel.
Yeah, I didn't. No. You know, I write short stories, too, and those are obviously always published on their own. But I don't think any of my novels have ever been, like, something plucked from it and published somewhere. Mm-hmm. We've tried, but often they're so interdependent. Mm-hmm. And so although when I'm writing a chapter, I see its arc, and I feel that it has a climax and a resolution, ultimately, I feel like it really needs the set pieces around it.
To be woven into the whole. Yeah.
Yeah.
One of these storylines has to do with a second marriage and the relationship between a stepmother and a stepdaughter. I wondered if you can talk a little bit about developing that particular storyline.
Well, I am a stepmother.
So am I.
You are too. And I had to actually...
We're an evil bunch.
Oh, we're just the worst. You know, I have to say that for many years I have struggled to write something in which a stepmother is humanized instead of demonized.
Yes.
And I failed because I think I was too defensive a lot of the time, and it came through. I would try to write a short story even, and I was so defensive, and my stepmothers were always super stepmother, great, and you know, and other mother was just the worst possible mother. It didn't work. You know, you could tell, you could see my motive. But my stepdaughter's now 21, and once she left for college, I would say, and became her own person and wasn't still under the auspices of her mother, mm-hmm. we developed a fabulous relationship, mm-hmm. you know, and she grew up quite far from us, and so there were always discussions and debates, may I even say arguments, about who was going to have her when, and the travel, and what we didn't do right. So they were very burdened and oppressive, and by the time the poor kid would arrive, we were all exhausted just from the negotiating.
Right.
Including her. And this was during the adoption process, one of the things I noticed as I sat in many groups was, wow, there's a lot of stepmothers where the father has older children and had no intention perhaps of having more, and here has married again, and here's a woman who wants to have a baby.
Right,
you know?
And he already had his vasectomy.
And he's had his vasectomy, absolutely. And so that was kind of, I saw a lot of it, so I thought that was a very realistic couple to present, and I saw finally I could write a true stepmother. You know, it took a long time for me to be happy with my stepmother in fiction.
Yeah.
But I love her, and she's believable.
She's believable, and she's kind, and she's flawed, and that's perfect.
Yes, that's right, and sometimes that kid drives her crazy. Sometimes she wishes she wasn't a stepmother, and sometimes she's exhausted from trying, and sometimes she doesn't try because of that. But she wants it to work.
Yeah.
And she's got obstacles, and sometimes the obstacle's her husband.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
You know what I thought was really smart that you did, and I don't know if this is why you did it, but we got to see that woman's name's Emily. We got to see Emily through the point of view of her narrative sections, mm-hmm. which aren't first-person point of view, but still you get her mindset, right? But then we also get to see her a little more closely than the other characters, because she's a good friend of Maya's, and Maya's the sort of the protagonist.
Yeah, she is the protagonist.
Right? And so we get to see a little bit more about Emily, which I think helps us understand her situation.
Right. And you know, that's why I love writing multiple points of view, because I love that it creates a character more like a prism. Mm-hmm. You know, they're reflected off other characters, but then they also get to shine. Mm-hmm. And I like that. So you see a situation or a person or their conflict completely differently once you can sort of show it in many ways.
Right.
So Maya, the main character who runs the Red Thread Adoption Agency, because we get to see her through Emily, we learn more about her as well. So I liked that relationship with the two of them.
Yeah. At least once in the novel, and I say at least once because when I realized it, I couldn't remember if this had happened before, but anyway, at least once in the novel, your main character, Maya, who founded the adoption agency, has a dream. Mm. Does she have multiple dreams?
You have to watch out with dreams in fiction, I have to say.
So well, that's what I want to ask
about. Yeah, there are either two or three.
There are two or three. Yeah, I thought she had, but I couldn't remember specifically.
Yeah, you know, when I teach writing, no dreams allowed, beginning writers, you know, and no one really wants to read a dream. But in her dream, I don't go through. And then she's, you know, walking down the street, and then the street becomes a ship. And then, you know, I don't give a detail. The point is that she always dreams of falling.
Right.
And that's important, but it's important to the storyline.
To the storyline, right.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So so I was just going to ask if you had any guidelines when you write dreams.
Yeah, don't write them. That's my guideline.
That's your guideline.
And so what I wanted was to capture the essence of why what she's dreaming, because we find out why she has this particular type of dream. But I also, she is a very controlled person. And by giving her a dream life, we can see another side of her, in a way.
Mm-hmm. And I would say that the fact that I don't remember there were two or three dreams probably means you did it pretty well.
Thank
because
you.
Sometimes they're really hard to get through.
Yeah.
not yours at all.
In fact, the first line of the book is in her dreams.
Okay.
In her sleep, Maya dreamed of falling.
Oh,
but
okay.
In her waking life, she was as solid as a tombstone. That is that is foreshadowing at its best or worst, depending on how you look
there
at it.
There you go.
Yeah.
The book is organized in various segments, larger segments, and they are titled Orientation, Home Study, Documents to China, Waiting, Referrals, and China. And each of these sections has an epigraph, which you talked about, these epigraphs introducing each of these larger sections. And then each of the larger sections is made up of smaller sections that correspond to the characters.
Everyone listening, their eyes are rolling.
No, they're not. No, it's just big chapters, and inside of those are little chapters.
Yeah.
So how did you organize yourself, and how did you decide to layer the book in this way?
You can tell I love playing with structure, obviously, from what you just said. I cannot write until I have, it's like a knitting pattern to me. I cannot write until I see the shape of the story. You know, it's no surprise that I love jigsaw puzzles, and I love crossword puzzles, and I love any kind of puzzling out. You know, I just, so even my first novel, when I didn't know what the heck I was doing, has a very complicated structure that I designed despite my lack of sort of confidence with writing and complicated structures. So that's just how I see the big picture.
So you're able to devise a structure without necessarily knowing what's going to happen, or do you know what's going to happen?
No. Well, both. I devise the structure to help me understand what's going to happen, and then I kind of fine-tune it once I know that.
And so sometimes the structure will change a little bit, or not?
A very little bit.
Yeah.
So the first thing I need is a container.
Uh-huh.
Which, actually, Aristotle said everything should have. He said, he suggested that a story be told in a time frame that we can see. So use spring, for example.
Oh, okay.
Right? And so it's certainly not my brilliant idea, but I like to know my container.
Mm-hmm.
So with the red thread, I thought, perfect, I will use the steps of adoption to contain my story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's the one, you know, orientation, etc. Documents to China, home study, documents to China. Those are all the steps on my check. I pulled out my checklist.
Right, right, right.
And there they were, six steps. Right? And I saw my little X's as each one happened. Okay, then I like multiple points of view. I like a lot of characters. But you always need one protagonist. So I have to develop a pattern for how I'm going to tell the story, always coming back to Maya, the main character.
Yeah. I thought that it was a very lovely flow. The story had a lovely flow, and we've just joked about how it sounds a little complicated. But I think part of what was great about this book is that you just give these individual characters' perspectives in little snapshots.
Yeah, they were like
glimpses.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
How do you approach revision, Anne?
I love revision, and I always have. I mean, I've never been afraid of it. One of the things that I find often with when I teach writing is people don't want to revise, and it's just shocking to me Because what I want is to tell a story, to tell it well, and to have people love it and understand. In order to love it, you have to understand it. So what's in my head does not come out on the paper understandably, clearly. I leave out huge things because I know my character so well, I forget to tell you, you know, the 20 things you need to know about him or her. And so revision makes it all work.
Yeah.
And so my process, which I love, I mean, I've grown to, I now have a process. As I said, that first book, I had a structure but didn't know what the heck I was doing. But now, by now, 10 or 11 books down the road, now I have a process. When I start to write on my writing day, I read aloud what I wrote the day before.
The whole thing.
Just what I wrote the day before. I don't go back to page one, but, you know, so sometimes I'm reading aloud 10 pages, sometimes it's only a few pages, depending on what I came up with the day before. Mm-hmm. And I read it aloud, and I'm fixing it as I'm reading. I'm saying, ugh, that sounds terrible, that's clunky, or, oh, I don't like that description, or, this is just wrong, it doesn't feel right. Mm-hmm. Some of it's just your gut. And so that's my first revision. It's right on the computer. It's the thing I wrote the day before. And then the next day, it's what I wrote the day before. So I'm moving forward. I don't get stuck in chapter one.
Right.
I keep moving forward. I don't ever have, when I sit down to write, a word count in mind. Because of my process, there are days when I would be in the negative. Some days I read what I wrote the day before and I'm just delete, awful, not good, and I'm stuck.
Mm.
So I would have zero word count. So I do it by, I need 2 hours today. Wherever I land in 2 hours, if it's more, it's great. But wherever I land at the end of my workday is where I land, you know. And then the next day I read aloud. And when I finally have a draft done, I print it out. I always say I take it for a date. I take that box from Kinko's and I go to my coffee shop and I open that box. And with a pen, I read from page one and I start revising. When I type in those changes, I revise them again, you know, or I sometimes say, oh, no, I liked it better that other way. I go back, you know, revision is very slippery.
Mm-hmm.
Back to Kinko's, back on a date, and I do it and do it until I have no more marks. The Knitting Circle, which is about 350 pages, was 700 pages.
Wow, the first draft.
Oh, first 10 drafts.
Oh, my gosh.
Because I hadn't written in a few years, I wrote The Knitting Circle, you know, I think I started it, I think 2 years after Grace died. I decided writing is fun, and I am just going to not self-edit. So each character's story was twice as long. Basically, that's what it was, and I had to just trim their stories to get to the essence of what served the book.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh, the things I know about those characters. And I never write that way. I'm always kind of editing as I write. Do I need this? Questioning myself. But because it was so fun to be writing again, I let their stories go. And there were times when I thought, some books have 700 pages. You know, some books are really long. My editor and agent were like, but not this one. So wisely, you know.
J.K. Rowling does it.
Yeah, I can think, how about John Irving and Pat Conroy?
They
write
nice
big fat books.
Whose work do you enjoy reading?
I love so many writers. It's so funny. It's kind of the hardest question because I could go on and on. I always start with, I love Ann Tyler. I love Alice Hoffman's writing. All the A's.
Yes.
I love those Swedish books by Henning Mankell, those detective books. And I love Laurie Moore and Jane Hamilton. All these people, when I see they have a new book out, you know, sign me up immediately. And then I love writers like Amy Bender, who are a little more experimental, you know. So it isn't like I have a type.
Right. I'm curious if you like Lisa C. Have you read Lisa C?
I only read her first book. I loved it.
Yeah. And I was trying to think if, you know, other writers who are doing Amy Tan.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I loved The Joy Luck Club when I read it. But interestingly, I reread that book before I wrote The Knitting Circle for structure ideas.
Oh, yeah.
Because I remember there were a lot of stories.
Right.
I after you've read a book long ago, you remember the heart of it. But I was like, in my memory, there are a lot of stories. How did she juggle all those?
Mm-hmm.
So I read The Joy Luck Club, and I read Whitney Otto's book, How to Make an American Quilt, for ideas on how they managed it.
Sure.
You know, but not for the Chinese piece. I didn't really read The Joy Luck Club again for that, or the other book you mentioned, the Lisa C, because I just read it.
Right. You mentioned earlier that you write stories as well, and you've written memoir. I'm curious if your process is different for each of these.
That's a great question that I haven't really ever thought about. Definitely not for stories. I think of my container. Mm-hmm. It's a summer. It's Thanksgiving Day. It's 3 weeks in a hospital, whatever. So I think of my container. Just like with my novels, I know my first and last line before I start.
Oh, that's a John Irving thing, too, I think.
It is a John Irving thing.
Yeah.
It's a lot of people, but actually I heard him give a talk at the Breadloaf Writers Conference, I don't even know, I'm saying 20 years ago, roughly, and I had the pleasure of having dinner at his house that night, and I asked him about that. And as he was talking, I realized I kind of did that too, but had never actually articulated it.
Uh-huh.
So now I thought, well, he said it so much more cleanly, but that's true. I do need to know. Sometimes it's an image. Mm-hmm. If I know my opening image, I know my closing image, and then so might it be the exact line. But the more I write, the more precise it gets, really.
Yeah.
And I do the same with short stories. And yeah, the same with essays and nonfiction too.
Okay.
Yeah, as I think, I'm thinking this through as we talk.
And memoir, when you wrote Comfort, for example?
You know, I always call Comfort the accidental memoir because I had no interest in writing a memoir, a book-length piece about grief, because I didn't want to, I know what it takes to write a book, and I didn't think I had the stamina or the bravery to revisit what had happened to us. For the amount of time and in the depth it takes to write a book-length piece. And so I was writing essays as I realized something about grief, like grief and food. I'd say, ah, and then I would write about it. And eventually I had, I don't know, 60, 70 pages of essays. And, you know, the powers that be, meaning agents, editors, people like that, were saying, please put it together, please put it together. And I couldn't see the connection between them. I mean, I knew the literal connection, the external connection. But I knew that they wouldn't publish a book of essays. It had to have a narrative thread. And I couldn't see that narrative thread. And then more essays were published. And I was at Yaddo, the artist colony in Saratoga Springs, New York. And I laid it all out on a desk that I had. It was actually kind of a table. And I looked at all these essays. And I realized that what each of them said is, this isn't logical. And I can't make sense of it, nor can you. And once I saw that, I was like, that's what connects it. That's what makes it a book, to be able to say. So I got a tattoo, and I learned to knit. And I still don't understand how to handle grief. So the acknowledgement of our powerlessness actually led me to connect them.
Okay. So it was a very different experience writing that book.
Yeah.
But it was a very different book that you probably never wanted to write.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. In my past shows, I always asked the same question of writers, and I've been finding myself feeling like this question's getting stale.
So okay.
You're my first writer where I'm doing something a little different.
Okay. It's like behind the actor's studio.
Yeah.
You have to say, okay.
I'm not going to do that.
Okay.
So I'm going to ask people from now on to think about a certain aspect of writing and then talk about what first comes to mind in the way of advice for writers around that aspect of writing. And I know that you have a book on creating characters, so I was going to ask you, what piece of advice do you have, just general piece of advice for writers when it comes to creating characters?
Don't create characters who are real based on real people.
Okay.
That is the biggest problem. And not for legal reasons. Sometimes people say, oh, because I'll get sued. No, because you're writing fiction. And so I think the best example I can give is in the knitting circle, I wanted to write a book about grief. And so I wrote down on Post-its what I thought the emotions attached to grief were. And I wrote down obvious ones, like horrible pain, bitterness, guilt. And then I surprised myself when I wrote love and hope. And ultimately I had 7 emotions that felt true, and I personified them through characters.
Mm.
And so when people say, is this a real person? That person came from me wanting to personify grief. So in the knitting circle, the character Scarlet is guilt. You know, the character Harriet is bitterness. And the character of Ellen is hope. And so they became real because they had an emotional life,
mm-hmm.
not a real life.
Right.
There's a difference, you know. And I did the same in The Red Thread. I wrote down what emotions propel people to want children, not just to adopt, but to want families.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the idea of making the world better. There was the idea of, I'm so great, I need to absolutely help the world by having a child.
Is that now?
Yeah. Right? There's grief.
Yeah.
I'm trying to heal myself.
Right.
So they spring from emotions instead of trying to have a character and then glue an emotion on. It's more organic.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking with me. This was great.
Thank you so much. It went so fast.
It did go fast.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Anne Hood. More information about her book, The Red Thread, published by W.W. Norton & Company, is available at annhood.us. So you may have just heard that I've stopped asking my guests that final question about writer's block. I felt that it was time for a change. However, before we leave the subject behind completely, we will look at it in more detail. Next week, tune in to hear an interview that's all about what gets us stuck in our day-to-day lives as well as in our creative lives and how we can get unstuck. I will speak with Vermont counselors and hypnotherapists Morella and Angelique DeVost. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the week. Ruth King Porter will read from her second novel, Ordinary Magic, at Bear Pond Books in Montpelier, Tuesday, September 28th at 7. Photographer Betsy Melvin will present her book, Robert Frost's New England, at Phoenix Books and Cafe in Essex, Saturday, October 2nd at 2. The Flying Pig Bookstore in Shelburne hosts two events for readers this week. On Monday, September 27th, that's today, at 4:30, Newbery author Cynthia Lord will read from her new children's novel, Touch Blue. And on Tuesday, September 28th, at 4:30, Australian author Catherine Jinks will be at Flying Pig to read from her new middle grade book, Genius Wars. More information about these two events is available at 802-985-3999 or flyingpigevents@gmail.com. This week we have two Write the Book prompts, both suggested by Anne Hood. The first is to write your autobiography in 500 words. And the second is to find a copy of Sandra Cisneros' very short story, My Name, which was part of her book, The House on Mango Street. Read that story and then write the story of your own name. Or if you're working on a piece of fiction, write the story of your character's name. Anne said that these exercises have proven very useful in classes that she's taught and that they really help details of character to emerge. Due to copyright laws, I can't reproduce Sandra Cisneros' lovely vignette, My Name, on my podcast site, but I'm sure that you can find a copy of The House on Mango Street yourself somewhere in the world. It's an amazing book. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about Write the Book or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about the station is available online at theradiator.org. Stay tuned, Cheryl Willoughby brings you the world of music in just a few minutes here. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.